On Thursday, June 13th, in the middle of the night, the SIT room called to relay the information that two tankers in the Gulf of Oman had been attacked. The Front Altair and the Kokuka Courageous, the latter Japanese-owned, were reporting fires and potential flooding, and a U.S. naval vessel was en route to render assistance. There was no immediate evidence who had struck, but there was no doubt in my mind. By 3 hours later, the fires had grown more serious, and nearby commercial vessels, one later determined to be the Hyundai Dubai, evacuated both crews. Iranian naval ships approached the Hyundai Dubai and demanded the sailors it had rescued be turned over, which they were. U.S. Central Command later posted these facts on its website, refuting Iran's outrageous claim that its navy rescued one of the crews. I arrived at the White House at 5:45 a.m., Kupperman having gotten there earlier, and went immediately to the SIT room. Reuters was already reporting, picked up by Al Jazeera, so the news was spreading rapidly across the Middle East. I left for the previously scheduled meeting in the tank. Shanahan and Dunford wanted a strategic discussion on Iran, which I said was fine, but we were now looking at an attack on the global oil market we simply couldn't ignore. The Quds Force was continuing up the escalation ladder, and why not? They certainly weren't seeing the United States do anything in response. Nonetheless, we slogged through the usual Pentagon array of charts, called placemats because of the size of the paper used. They had lines and columns and arrows, all very artistic. Finally, I said our various policy priorities with Iran, nuclear, terrorism, conventional military aggression, could not be delinked, and we particularly could not separate Iran's nuclear program from all its other malign behavior. This was precisely Obama's mistake on the nuclear deal. Why return to his failed analytical framework? I argued again that whether or not it was our declared end state, a favored bureaucratic term, there would be no new Iran deal and no deterrence established as long as Iran's current regime remained. You could like it or not, but basing policy on some other reality would not get us to any end state we sought. Whether this discussion was productive or not, or whether it would just lead to another set of elaborate placemats, remained to be seen. Heading back to the White House, I called Trump. I described our meeting in the tank, and also what was happening in the Gulf of Oman, some of which Fox had already broadcast. "Play it down," said Trump, which was yet again the wrong approach, but which reflected his view that if you pretended bad things hadn't happened, perhaps no one else would notice. By the time I reached the West Wing, our information was unambiguous that this was an Iranian attack. We were all amazed to see film of Iranian sailors approach the Kokuka Courageous and remove a mine that hadn't detonated from the hull of the ship. How brazen could you get? I briefed Pence, who was in Montana, returning later in the day. Hearing the results of Abe's meeting with Khamenei later in the day underlined the tank discussion. Khamenei took notes as Abe spoke, but said at the end that he had no response, which was all but insulting. Moreover, Khamenei was far tougher than Rouhani had been the day before. This showed the folly of Macron and others, Trump included, talking to Rouhani rather than the supreme leader. Was there something unclear about that title? Moreover, even before Abe boarded his plane back to Japan, and contrary to his explicit request not to publicize the meeting, Khamenei issued a long string of tweets. The two most critical from our perspective were, "We have no doubt in at Abe Shinzo's goodwill and seriousness, but regarding what you mentioned from U.S. President, I don't consider Trump as a person deserving to exchange messages with. I have no response for him and will not answer him. We do not believe at all that the U.S. is seeking genuine negotiations with Iran, because genuine negotiations would never come from a person like Trump. Genuineness is very rare among U.S. officials." The conclusion was plain. Abe's mission had failed. Iran had effectively slapped Abe in the face, attacking civilian ships near Iran, one of which was Japanese-owned, even as he was simultaneously meeting with Khamenei. Nonetheless, the Japanese were in denial, perhaps trying to shield Abe from the humiliation Trump had urged him into. Pompeo and I met with Trump at 12:15, and I showed him Khamenei's tweets. "Nasty," he said. "Very nasty," before launching into a long riff on how Kerry was preventing him from negotiating with Iran. Trump wanted to respond to Khamenei's tweets, which eventually emerged as, "While I very much appreciate PM Abe going to Iran to meet with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, I personally feel that it is too soon to even think about making a deal. They are not ready, and neither are we. It is the assessment of the U.S. government that Iran is responsible for today's attacks in the Gulf of Oman." On Friday morning, Abe gave Trump a personal readout of his trip, saying that he had seen no willingness from either Rouhani or Khamenei to have a dialogue with the United States as long as the economic sanctions remained in place. At least Abe complained that Iran immediately made the meeting public, but he nonetheless thought Rouhani really did want a dialogue with the U.S., waxing poetic about how Rouhani had run after him in the hallway after the Khamenei meeting to say that lifting sanctions would be conducive to opening such a dialogue. Worst of all, Abe remained locked into the idea that Iran and North Korea were very different cases, saying we needed a different approach to Iran. They really had blinders on. Trump said Abe should not feel guilty that he had totally and absolutely failed. But he then backed off, perhaps thinking he had been a tad harsh, saying he just wanted to have a little fun. He hadn't expected Abe to succeed, and he was not surprised at all at the result. He turned to what was really on his mind, saying he really appreciated the effort, but that it was really much more important to him personally that Japan buy more U.S. farm products. The U.S. was doing a lot for Japan, defending it and losing a lot of money on trade. Abe acknowledged that he was considering what to do, and Trump said that the sooner he could do it, the better, like immediately. Then, back on Iran, Trump said Abe didn't need to bother to negotiate with them anymore, given the very nasty statements Iran had issued after Abe's meetings. Trump would do the negotiating himself, which he tweeted soon after the call. We had an NSC meeting scheduled to begin right after the Abe call, but it was late getting started. Trump began by summarizing his discussion with Abe, and after a riff on Kerry's violating the Logan Act, Trump looked at Cipollone and Eisenberg, saying, "The lawyers refuse to do it. I can't understand it. It's ridiculous you don't do it." Shanahan and Dunford wanted to get a better sense of Trump's intent, and in the course of doing that, they showed a new set of placemats with some interesting public statistics on oil purchases by various countries from the Middle East, showing very high imports from the Middle East for China, South Korea, Japan, India, and Indonesia. I knew what was coming. Why didn't these importing countries do more? And why didn't they and Middle East oil producers pay more to safeguard their own oil shipments? By the time Shanahan and Dunford got to the fourth or fifth chart, Trump had begun losing interest, saying, "Let's go to the what do you want to do page." We discussed the various options but came to no conclusions. Then Trump was back to exiting Syria and Afghanistan and making the Gulf Arab states pay for whatever we decided to do. I explained, as I had before, that the Bush 41 administration raised substantial support to pay for the 1991 Gulf War. Pompeo assured Trump he would call the appropriate regional countries. Trump left, although Pence, Pompeo, Dunford, Shanahan, and I continued the conversation. Dunford wanted to be sure Trump understood that if we inflicted casualties on Iran, Iran's moratorium on killing Americans would end. I asked, "What moratorium?" given the number of Americans Iran had killed, starting with the Marine barracks in Lebanon in 1983. The casualty issue was much on the minds of everyone in this and other meetings with Trump. Pence said he thought it was clear Trump wanted kinetic options, which is also how I read him. This was one of a long and growing list of discussions where there was no doubt Trump wanted to consider such options, not that he had decided on anything, and that he was getting frustrated at not having more options before him. There was still considerable work before the next meeting on Monday, but I thought at least no one could fault us for not being exhaustive in considering the implications of using military force. On Monday, June 17th, however, we still did not reach a decision. The bureaucracies and key officials took advantage of Trump's impatience and short attention span to delay a response to the attacks on the tankers. That pushed things beyond the point where military action seemed appropriate. The obstructionists didn't have their own plan, but they counted, successfully, on delay to frustrate any alternative. Most important, they continued to miss the point that failing to act not only enabled Iran to advance its hegemonic aspirations in the Gulf, but it also taught them the wrong lessons about deterrence. They were not impressed by American restraint, but were increasingly convinced we were no obstacle at all. We were simply getting in our own way. Demonstrating the point even before the 10 a.m. NSC meeting, a spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran announced it was not waiting until July 8th to violate key nuclear deal limits, but had already started doing so. Iran would breach the low-enriched uranium storage limit, 300 kilograms, in 10 days, and the limit on stored heavy water, 130 tons, within 2 to 3 months. Enriching to U-235 levels above the deal's 3.67% limit could start in a matter of days or hours, since it involved only mechanical changes in the centrifuge cascade systems doing the enrichment. Iran obviously intended to increase pressure on the Europeans, who were desperately trying to save the nuclear deal, but more important, Tehran was also proving that its key objective was the nuclear weapons program. Asked if Iran would withdraw from the nuclear deal, the spokesman said, "If we continue this way, this will effectively occur." Shanahan, Dunford, Pompeo, and I met in my office before the NSC meeting to go over the options the Pentagon had prepared. Unfortunately, they had brought basically the same set we had discussed on Friday, as to which Trump said even then, "We should have hit something immediately after the tankers were hit. My military hasn't been giving me options." Pompeo opened the NSC meeting, saying he was making progress with the Gulf Arab countries on financing future operations. "I am confident they will write significant checks." "They should," said Trump. "We don't need their oil anymore. I just don't want Iran to have nuclear weapons." By now, he had his own ideas about what targets to hit, and they were well beyond the options the Defense Department proposed. Trump may or may not have realized it, but he was making an important point about how to re-establish deterrence, a favorite Pentagon phrase. The Joint Chiefs preferred to do so by a proportionate response, tit for tat, that no one could criticize them for. But in my judgment, it was far likelier that a disproportionate response, such as attacking oil refineries or aspects of Iran's nuclear weapons program, was necessary to re-establish deterrence. The point was to convince Iran it would face costs far higher than it was imposing on us or our friends if it used force. As of now, Iran had paid no costs at all. Even Obama at least threatened attacking Iran, although the seriousness of his statements was open to question. That, unfortunately, was what we were still doing, not pursuing options. We agreed merely to increase personnel, making defensive preparations for U.S. forces in the region, and we had trouble even issuing a press release to that effect by day's end. Moreover, that modest news was overwhelmed by Iran's blowing past the nuclear deal limits. Tehran was still on the move toward nuclear weapons while we watched the grass grow. The next day, in a Time magazine interview, Trump described the initial and most recent attacks as very minor. "I wondered why I bothered coming to the West Wing every morning. this practically invited something more serious. Just as a starter, on Wednesday, rockets were fired in Basra, likely by Shia militia groups aimed at the local headquarters of three foreign oil companies, Exxon, Shell, and Eni, causing several injuries but no fatalities. The response of the Iraqi government was to announce a ban on attacks from its territory against foreign states. It would have been nice if Iraq treated Iranian military forces and Shia surrogates on its territory at least equally to the U.S., but that was impossible given Iran's dominance in Baghdad. We refused to acknowledge this reality, even as it continued to expand, as it had been doing for several years. And a D.C. that morning produced no interest in responding to the rocket attacks. The IRGC's new commander, Hossein Salami, and its Quds Force commander, Qasem Soleimani, had to be smiling broadly. The bigger news that day was that Shanahan withdrew his nomination to be Secretary of Defense. Reports of family turmoil caused by his former wife had resurfaced, which he did not want sensationalized in his confirmation hearings. It was a great tragedy, but one couldn't begrudge his desire to shield his family from more unhappiness. Trump decided almost immediately to nominate Army Secretary Mark Esper, a West Point classmate of Pompeo's, for the job, calling him immediately from the Oval. Back in my office, I called Esper myself to say congratulations and to get started on his formal nomination. The next day, Esper came to the White House in the late afternoon for pictures with Trump, and we talked beforehand about the current Iran crisis while waiting for the meeting and pictures. Afterward, Esper and I walked back to my office where he got a call that a Saudi desalinization plant's power station had been hit by a Houthi missile. Esper departed immediately for the Pentagon, and I called Dunford, who had not yet heard of the attack. I walked to the Oval at 6:20 p.m. to tell Trump, and he asked if we should meet immediately to consider what to do. I was worried this report might be mistaken or overstated, so I said we should wait until Thursday morning to consider what to do. I called Dunford and filled in Pompeo, telling them both that we would caucus the next morning. While this strike against the Shukaik desalinization plant seemed like a big deal at the time, a much bigger deal was the sitroom's call that night around 9:30 that Iran had shot down another U.S. drone, the second one in less than 2 weeks, this one an RQ-4A Global Hawk over the Strait of Hormuz. The weekly breakfast with Shanahan and Pompeo was already scheduled for Thursday morning, and Esper and Dunford had been added after the attack on the desalinization plant, so we were already ready to confer. We convened the next morning, June 20th, at 7 a.m. in the wardroom. Dunford reported first that, at the request of the Saudis, Central Command Commander Frank McKenzie had a team heading to the Shukaik plant to assess the damage and identify what weapons had hit the facility, which, as with many such Saudi plants, also served as a power generation station. We agreed a Central Command officer should give a public briefing as soon as possible in order to get the word out widely. Far more important was Dunford's reaction to the downing of the Global Hawk. He characterized that incident, which resulted in the destruction of a U.S. asset variously estimated in the media to cost between $120 and $150 million, as qualitatively different from the others in the long list of attacks and provocations over the past several months, in response to which we had done nothing. Dunford was completely convinced the remotely piloted surveillance aircraft had always been in international airspace, although it likely flew through a zone Iran unilaterally designated as over its waters, which only Iran recognized. Dunford suggested we hit three sites along Iran's coast. These three sites, while probably not themselves involved in downing the Global Hawk, were nonetheless commensurable. One of his key points was that he thought this response proportional and non-escalatory. Precisely because I thought we needed a significantly greater response to reestablish deterrence, I suggested we add other elements from options lists discussed earlier with Trump after the tanker attacks. We went back and forth for some time, and it was clear all of us thought we should retaliate for the attack, although Pompeo and I argued for a stronger response than Dunford and Shanahan. Esper, new to the issue, was largely silent. Ultimately, we compromised on destroying the three sites and several other measures. I said I wanted to be sure we were all in agreement so I could tell Trump his advisors would present a unanimous recommendation. This was a good thing for the president. While he obviously had the final decision, no one could say he had come down too hard or too soft on Iran if he chose our package. Nor would there be an opportunity for the media's favorite pastime of exposing conflict among his advisors. Subsequent press reports, quoting only anonymous sources, asserted that Dunford did not concur with Trump's decision. That is simply not true. Dunford and everyone else at the breakfast agreed. As we were talking, Trump decided he wanted to meet congressional leaders. There was a meeting with them scheduled for later that afternoon, before making a final decision. I called him immediately upon leaving the breakfast to explain our conversation and said his senior advisors had agreed on a response and that we thought our unanimity would be helpful to him. Trump instantly agreed, and I had the distinct sense he knew he had to do something in response to the Global Hawk's destruction. This was too much to accept without a military response. His tweet before the NSC meeting was clear. Iran made a very big mistake. Mulvaney later said he also thought Trump would act and wanted the Hill briefing to provide political cover for whatever he decided to do. The NSC meeting actually began on time at 11 a.m., showing even Trump took this seriously. Pence, Esper, Shanahan, Dunford, Pompeo, Haspel, Mulvaney, Cipollone, Eisenberg, and I attended. With so many NSC meetings and other conversations among the key people in the weeks beforehand, the issues were hardly novel or lacking substantial foundations of prior consideration and discussion. I introduced the issues facing us and then asked Dunford to explain what had happened to the Global Hawk. He said that our unmanned vehicle cost $146 million. It had been flying throughout its mission in international airspace, including when it was shot down. And we knew the location of the battery that had launched the missile that destroyed it, based on calculations and experience analogous to airplane crash investigations. Dunford then presented the proposal we had agreed upon at breakfast, namely to hit three other sites and the other measures. The rest of us who attended the breakfast said we agreed with Dunford. Eisenberg said he wanted to look at it, but expressed no reservation there might be any legal issues. He in no way, shape, or form asked what the level of casualties might be from these strikes. Trump asked if the sites were Russian and how expensive they were, and Dunford assured him they were Russian-made, but not as expensive as our drone. We discussed whether there might be Russian casualties, which was doubtful but not impossible. Dunford said the attacks would be in the dead of night, so that the number of people manning the site would be small, although he did not give a precise number, nor was he asked to by anyone present. It was clear to me from Trump's manner that he wanted to hit more than what we suggested. When he asked about this possibility in various ways, I said, "We can do it all at once, we can do it in pieces, we can do it as you like." Just so Trump understood we couldn't foreclose his looking at other options by presenting an agreed-upon recommendation. Restoring U.S. credibility and our utterly negligible deterrence against a nuclear weapons-aspiring, theocratic, militarist rogue state would have justified a lot more, but I didn't feel I needed to make that argument. I was certain Trump would at least approve the agreed-upon package from breakfast. Dunford opposed anything other than the breakfast idea, although he was very confident of success against that package, as we all were. The discussion went on, although Pompeo sat mostly silent. "Bolton as a moderate," Trump said at one point, because I was supporting the breakfast package, and everyone laughed. Turning to the question of financing, I said, "This will be a profit-making operation. And Pompeo again described his encouraging fundraising efforts to date, in which he was also seeking actual military participation in joint naval patrols and the like. He was leaving over the weekend for further consultations in the region. "Don't talk about talks," said Trump. "Just ask for the money and the patrols." Trump then set off into the Kerry-Logan Act riff, without which no meeting on Iran was really official. I brought the discussion to a conclusion by summarizing the decision, which was the breakfast package. Trump agreed and wanted to put out a statement, dictating we would make a minor response to an unforced error by the Iranians. Since the retaliation should have come as a surprise to Iran, no one else agreed, and the idea got lost in the shuffle. Trump asked when the strike would take place, and Dunford said they were estimating 9 p.m. Washington time, by which he meant time on target. Dunford also said, "Mr. President, we will be back to you if they try to kill Americans in response." And Trump said, "I don't think so. I am worried about our soldiers in Syria. Get them out." Dunford answered, "We want to get to that point." And Trump answered, "Syria is not our friend." There were three significant aspects about the decision just reached. 1. We were hitting functioning military targets, as explained earlier, not merely symbolic ones. 2. We were hitting inside Iran, crossing an Iranian red line, and we were certainly going to test their repeated assertions that such an attack would be met by a full-scale response. And 3. We were hitting targets likely entailing casualties, which question we had confronted. Trump, having heard that the attacks he had ordered meant dead Iranians and possibly dead Russians. After the fact, there were alternative theories about Trump's stunning decision to cancel the strike, but I believe strongly that Trump knew exactly what he was doing when he made the decision. We had scheduled a congressional briefing to which Pelosi arrived 20 minutes late. Trump waited with the rest of us in the cabinet room, and there was a stilted, to say the least, conversation. Huawei came up, and Chuck Schumer said, "You've got Democrats on your side," regarding being tough on Huawei. Senator Mark Warner, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, chimed in to add, "There is no security with a Huawei network. We could lose credibility with our allies if we used it for trade," meaning exacting trade concessions from Beijing in exchange for rescinding the Huawei penalties. Warner was right on this, but Trump believed everything was open in trade negotiations. When Pelosi finally rolled in, Trump explained the situation. Adam Schiff, the Democratic chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, asked what our plans were. Trump ducked by saying, "They, the Iranians, want to talk," but blamed Kerry's violation of the Logan Act for discouraging them. The Democrats worried about the use of military force, but Trump teased the idea of a hit, but not a hit that's going to be so devastating. Trump said later, "Doing nothing is the biggest risk," prompting Jim Risch to interject, "I agree," and all Republicans concurred. Mike McCall, Republican Texas, asked whether we could destroy the sites in Iran from which the attack had come. I hope all of us kept straight faces when Trump answered, "I can't comment, but you'll be happy." Mitch McConnell asked, "How is this different from other periodic outbursts over the past number of years?" Trump responded correctly, "It's not this incident. It's where they want to go. We can't let them have it, nuclear weapons." Dunford added, "What's qualitatively different is that it's a direct attack from Iran. It's attributable." This meeting ended at 4:20, and preparations for the attack accelerated. Expecting I would be in the White House all night, I went home at about 5:30 to get a change of clothes and return. Dunford had confirmed 7 p.m. was the go-no-go point for the strike against the three Iranian sites, so I figured I had plenty of time before the 9 p.m. hit. I called Trump from the Secret Service SUV at about 5:35 and told him everything was on track. "Okay," he said. "Let's go." I talked to Shanahan at 5:40 about the kind of statements he and Dunford would make at the Pentagon once the attacks concluded and whether they should take questions or just read written statements. I reached home, changed clothes, and turned around immediately, running into heavy inbound traffic on the George Washington Memorial Parkway. As I was riding in, Shanahan called with what turned out to be an erroneous report that the UK embassy in Iran had been attacked and that he and Dunford had decided to delay the time on target point to 10 o'clock p.m. The source of this information was a UK liaison officer at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but Shanahan said Pompeo was checking and determined that it was a trivial automobile accident. I couldn't believe the Pentagon had changed the time of the attack entirely on its own, especially based on the scanty information involved. I called Trump to say we might have to postpone the attack for an hour, although we were still checking things out. Trump also didn't understand why we had to delay things, but he didn't object. I called Dunford just after hanging up with Trump and was told the two of them were talking. Worried now that perhaps Shanahan and Dunford had gotten cold feet, I called Pompeo, who was at his residence, to compare notes. He thought Shanahan and Dunford were panicking and were completely out of line. They had argued to him we should wait a couple of days in light of the attack on the British embassy to see if we could get the Brits to join the retaliation, although in light of subsequent events, this idea never went any further. It got worse. As Pompeo and I were talking, the sit room broke in to say Trump wanted to have a conference call with the two of us, Shanahan and Dunford. Trump came on the line at perhaps 7:20. I was now slowly crossing the Roosevelt Bridge across the Potomac, to say he had decided to call the strikes off because they were not proportionate. 150-1, he said, and I thought perhaps he was referring to the number of missiles we might fire compared to one Iranian missile that had brought down the Global Hawk. Instead, Trump said he had been told by someone unnamed there might be 150 Iranian casualties. Too many body bags, said Trump, which he was not willing to risk for an unmanned drone. Not proportionate, he said again. Pompeo tried to reason with him, but he wasn't having it. Saying we could always strike later, Trump cut the discussion off, repeating he didn't want to have a lot of body bags on television. I tried to change his mind, but I got nowhere. I said I was nearing the White House and would come to the Oval when I arrived. In my government experience, this was the most irrational thing I ever witnessed any president do. It called to mind Kelly's question to me, what would happen if we ever got into a real crisis with Trump as president? Well, now we had one, and Trump had behaved bizarrely, just as Kelly had feared. As I arrived at the White House entrance on West Executive Avenue shortly after 7:30 p.m., Kupperman was outside to greet me to say the strike was off. I went by my office to drop off my briefcase and went straight to the Oval where I found Cipollone, Eisenberg, and a Mulvaney staffer. I had a thoroughly surreal conversation with Trump, during which I learned that Eisenberg, on his own, had gone into the Oval with the 150 casualties number, a figure drawn up somewhere in the Defense Department, on which I learned more the next day, arguing it was illegal to retaliate in such a disproportionate way. This was all utter nonsense. Both the so-called casualty figure, which no senior official had examined, and the legal argument, which was a grotesque misstatement of the proportionality principle. After the event, commentators circulated a quotation from Stephen Schwebel, former U.S. Chief Judge of the International Court of Justice, that in the case of action taken for the specific purpose of halting and repelling an armed attack, this does not mean that the action should be more or less commensurate with the attack. Trump said he had called Dunford, probably the point where I tried to reach him, after Eisenberg spoke to him, and Dunford didn't dispute the decision. Dunford told me the next day that was incorrect, but the damage was already done. I was at a loss for words, which must have been apparent to everyone in the Oval. I tried to explain that the purported casualty figures were almost entirely conjectural, but Trump wasn't listening. He had in mind pictures of 150 body bags, and there was no explaining to be done. He offered no other justification, simply repeating his worry about television pictures of dead Iranians. Trump said finally, "Don't worry, we can always attack later, and if we do, it'll be much tougher." A promise worth exactly what I paid for it. I went to my office and called Pompeo at 7:53 p.m. at his residence. We were both in the same mood. I described the scene in the Oval, lighting Pompeo off on Eisenberg, who had, when Pompeo was director of the CIA, once blocked some agency action with the same kind of irresponsible, half-baked intercession. Pompeo had never forgiven him. Kupperman, who was in his office right next to mine the entire time, confirmed that Eisenberg didn't try to speak with him, didn't try to reach me, and didn't try to find Cipollone or Mulvaney. He simply rushed into the Oval to tell Trump he was about to kill 150 Iranians. This was utterly inaccurate, unfiltered, and unconsidered, but just the kind of fact that inflamed Trump's attention, as it had here. No process, period. "This is really dangerous," said Pompeo, as we discussed the day's errors, most notably throwing away a decision based on a consensus analysis and assessment of the relevant data simply because Eisenberg, at the last minute, without consulting anyone, thought Trump should hear a fact that wasn't a fact at all, one that was completely wrong. As Pompeo put it, "There are times when you just want to say, you people figure it out." After I got off the phone, Kupperman told me Pence had returned to the White House, still expecting a 9 p.m. time-on-target attack, and wanted to know what had happened. I went to the VP's office at about 8 o'clock and we talked for 20 minutes. Pence was as dumbfounded as I was. He agreed to go down the hall to see Trump and find out if there was any way to reverse the decision, but there obviously was not. I left for home about 8:40 p.m. I had thought about resigning several times before, but this, for me, was a turning point. If this was how we were going to make crisis decisions, and if these were the decisions being made, what was the point? I had been at the White House slightly over 14 months. I wasn't looking for long-distance records. On Friday, June 21st, with confused media stories rampant, Mulvaney said he had spoken with Cipollone and Eisenberg the night before, and that Eisenberg had conceded he had talked to no one before charging into the Oval, asserting there was no time before the go-no-go point. Eisenberg also had no explanation why the Defense Department's fact only emerged at the last minute, and, proving how far out of the loop he was, he didn't know the attack had already been set back an hour. There had been ample time for more considered judgment. Mulvaney concluded from Eisenberg's muddled answers and Cipollone's lack of awareness that Eisenberg's behavior was unacceptable. There had been a number of unacceptable process fouls on Thursday, Eisenberg's being the worst. I spoke with Pompeo afterward, and we rehashed the worst moments of the prior day. On the chimerical idea of the attack on the UK embassy in Tehran, Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt, whom Pompeo had woken to get the facts, wrote Pompeo an email saying, in Pompeo's paraphrase, "Always glad to talk to you, but why did you wake me in the middle of the night? Some jackass drives a car into the gate at our embassy? Nothing new in our world." So much for that fantasy. We spoke again later in the morning, and Pompeo said, reflecting again on Thursday's events, "I can't do what he, Trump, wants me to do. It's massively unfair. I can't do it. We put our people at risk. And you know what will happen when I see him today for lunch. He's going to spin me. He's going to say, 'Mike, you know this is the right thing to do, right?'" I asked Pompeo how he planned to handle this spin, which would come not because Trump doubted his decision, but because he wanted Pompeo to accept his line. Pompeo responded, "I'll say, 'Sir, that's one view. Let me give you my theory. If I were a parent of a child at Assad Air Base, I'd feel more at risk,' to try to make it personal to him. 'I'd say, If we leave this unanswered, the risk of a nuclear Iran goes up. That was all true, but neither of us believed it would sway Trump. He never tried to conform me to this line, perhaps because he didn't care anymore, or never had. Pompeo said he had stayed up until 2 a.m., so distressed had he been. He felt the Thursday breakfast consensus was firm enough to be the basis for a strike decision. Reversing that decision undercut all our arguments about Iran. He said, "I can give him, Trump, latitude in what he decides he wants, but I can't figure out how to do what he wants. We can keep telling people we are concerned about Iran's missile programs, but who will believe us?" There was more, but Pompeo's comment here actually revealed a significant divergence between us. I was not so prepared to give Trump latitude in what he decided, since so much of it was badly wrong. I urged that we keep saying what we have been saying. We had just had the crisis Kelly predicted, and Trump had behaved just as irrationally as he feared. We agreed not to resign without calling each other first, which was the first time that subject had come up. I wouldn't at all characterize this as a lengthy exchange on the pros and cons of resigning, which it wasn't, but the subject was obviously hanging in the air. Trump had a call set with Mohammed bin Salman, and before making it, he asked my opinion about a statement he was thinking of tweeting. I didn't object, thinking to myself, why not? Things went so badly wrong the day before, how could a few tweets make it worse? Here they are. President Obama made a desperate and terrible deal with Iran, gave them $150 billion plus $1.8 billion in cash. Iran was in big trouble, and he bailed them out, gave them a free path to nuclear weapons, and soon. Instead of saying thank you, Iran yelled, "Death to America." I terminated deal, which was not even ratified by Congress, and imposed strong sanctions. They are a much weakened nation today than at the beginning of my presidency, when they were causing major problems throughout the Middle East. Now they are bust. On Monday, they shot down an unmanned drone flying in international waters. We were cocked and loaded to retaliate last night on three different sites when I asked, "How many will die?" 150 people, sir, was the answer from a general. 10 minutes before the strike, I stopped it. Not proportionate to shooting down an unmanned drone. I am in no hurry. Our military is rebuilt, new and ready to go, by far the best in the world. Sanctions are biting, and more added last night. Iran can never have nuclear weapons, not against the USA and not against the world. I suppose I really thought, if he wants to put something out that foolish, who am I to object? I believed Trump would own it so totally after those tweets that perhaps people would understand how idiosyncratic the whole thing had been. It was wounding to lay all this out in public, but there was no stopping Trump from revealing himself. I called Dunford at 8:45 to get his version of what had happened. He said he had been up until 1 in the morning trying to chase down the casualty point just in case Trump changed his mind again when he woke Friday morning. Dunford was not happy, saying Trump had basically called him feckless during the sit-room meeting because he thought Dunford's target options were too small, and then later called off the retaliation entirely because it was too large. Good point. On the casualty issue, Dunford said, well after the sit-room meeting, Pentagon lawyers asked what the potential Iranian casualties might be. Dunford had said, "We don't know," which is what he had said in the sit-room. The lawyers then searched for a table of organization that might lay out the manning pattern for the kinds of targets we had selected and somehow concluded it would be 50 people per battery. "This is all lawyers," said Dunford, meaning no one with hands-on combat or command responsibility was involved in this estimation. As best Dunford knew, as the attack moved toward launch, there was no legal issue. No one had flashed a yellow light. At 7:13 p.m., said Dunford, Trump called to say he had heard there could be 150 dead Iranians. Dunford said he responded, "No, it's not 150. First, said Dunford, we were already down to two sites rather than three because one we had identified had already packed up and moved, and we weren't sure where it was. That meant potential deaths were 100 at most, even by the lawyers' estimates. As for the two remaining sites, Dunford said they assessed that it would be 50 people per site max, and tried to explain to Trump why, in the middle of the night, Iran time, the numbers at the site were likely to be far smaller. He couldn't break through, as Trump said, I don't like it. They didn't kill any of our people. I want to stop it. Not 150 people. I then explained to Dunford what had happened from my perspective, with Eisenberg's running into the Oval with the lawyer's estimate. I could sense Dunford shaking his head in amazement on the other end of the phone. I just want the president to own it, he said. He didn't want to own it last night. There are consequences when that happens. He trailed off. Dunford then said, and the tweets this morning. He's telling the Iranians, do what you want as long as you don't hurt Americans. That means they can do everything else they want. That was exactly right. Trump said later in the morning that his tweets were perfect and said, Tehran is just like here. People are meeting in rooms discussing this. Another example of Trump's mirror imaging, along with the Iranians are dying to talk. And then, we learned later, he deputized Rand Paul to speak to the Iranians. When I passed this news to Pompeo on Saturday, he was simply speechless, having the same reaction as I. It was mind-boggling Trump would entrust anything sensitive to Paul, let alone something that could determine the fate of his presidency. I told Pompeo I was meeting with Netanyahu on Sunday in Jerusalem, and it might well be a landmark performance if I said what I really thought, thereby certainly finishing my tenure as National Security Advisor. Pompeo joked, it'll be a twofer in that case. After our several Friday conversations, I did think Pompeo was serious about all this. If he was, we would be in uncharted waters if both of us resigned simultaneously. While that was still unlikely, we were a lot closer than we had ever been before. Reporters were asking Trump about me, and he said as he left for Camp David on Saturday, I disagree very much with John Bolton. John Bolton is doing a very good job, but he takes a generally tough posture. I have other people that don't take that posture, but the only one that matters is me. One had to wonder how much longer I should remain. In any case, I left for Israel a few hours later, there being no reason not to, since the strike had been called off. In Israel, I reviewed where things stood on Iran. Netanyahu and his team focused on the latest information gleaned from Israel's daring raid on Iran's nuclear archives and the subsequent International Atomic Energy Agency inspection of the Turkizabad site, which revealed human-processed uranium. It was not enriched uranium, but perhaps yellowcake, uranium oxide in solid form, and certainly evidence contradicting Tehran's repeated assertions it had never had a nuclear weapons program. Iran had tried to sanitize Turkizabad as it had tried to sanitize Lavizan in 2004 and the explosive test chambers at Parchin between 2012 and 2015, but it had failed again. This could well be evidence Iran kept alive its Ahmad plan for nuclear weapons well after it was supposedly ended in 2004 and would definitely put Tehran on the defensive internationally. Back in Washington, the Pentagon, characteristically, was opposing sanctions Trump had finally decided to impose on the Supreme Leader's office. It was insisting on an NSC meeting before going forward, which was badly timed, since both Pompeo and I were out of the country. Nonetheless, a meeting was convened, which I attended via a satellite video hookup from the former U.S. consulate building in Jerusalem, now the temporary embassy. Esper and Dunford said they were worried the proposed sanctions would inhibit our ability to negotiate with Iran. Pompeo, unable to participate because of travel, said he told Esper later that he was touched by their concern, but he thought he could handle it. Trump broke in to say, "Even our enemies liked that we didn't attack." No kidding. "We have capital accumulated. It was the most presidential act in decades. It worked out very well." Mnuchin pressed for the executive order he had drafted, not actually sanctioning Khamenei, but only his office, which I thought was a mistake. Trump responded, "It would be much more effective if we designated the supreme leader," which was unquestionably true. More confused discussion ensued, and Trump said, "We really didn't know what the sanctions' effect would be. Actually, I think it will help with the talks. Most would say it helps with the talks. And why aren't we doing Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani? Put his name in there." When someone suggested Soleimani might already be covered by other sanctions, Trump said, "Put his name in anyway. John, would you put his name in there?" "Yes, sir," I said. "Would you put the Supreme Leader's name in there?" "Yes, sir," I said again. "I don't know if it's good or bad, but I want to do it. Put it in. They have to have a reason to negotiate. Add Zarif," said Trump, further making my day. "Make them, the sanctions, strong, super strong," Trump concluded. By raising these issues and trying to block the draft executive order, Dunford and Esper had made things worse for their own position. It served them right. I also thought Trump was showing the others that despite his wretched Thursday evening decision over my objections, as everyone knew, I was not yet about to be fired. I considered the outcome of the NSC meeting near total victory. Secretary of State Paul later persuaded Trump to defer the Zarif sanctions for 30 days. I wonder if he cleared that with Secretary of State Giuliani. By the end of July, however, Trump, reversing course again, was ready to authorize sanctions on Zarif, which we did. In Washington, Trump tweeted, "Iran leadership doesn't understand the words nice or compassion. They never have. Sadly, the thing they do understand is strength and power, and the USA is by far the most powerful military force in the world, with $1.5 trillion invested over the last 2 years alone. The wonderful Iranian people are suffering, and for no reason at all. Their leadership spends all of its money on terror and little on anything else. The U.S. has not forgotten Iran's use of IEDs and EFPs, bombs, which killed 2,000 Americans and wounded many more." Iran's very ignorant and insulting statement put out today only shows that they do not understand reality. Any attack by Iran on anything American will be met with great and overwhelming force. In some areas, overwhelming will mean obliteration. No more John Kerry and Obama.
As if the debacle after the global hawk downing were not enough, we immediately faced a diplomatic onslaught from Macron. On his own misguided initiative, he had been working Rouhani hard so Iran didn't blow through the nuclear deal's critical limits on its nuclear activities. Macron unquestionably saw easing sanctions against Iran as the key to starting negotiations, or else the European Union's precious nuclear deal would be on the way to the boneyard. Without U.S. concessions, in Macron's view, Iran would never come to the table, which was just fine with me. In preparation for a call with Macron on Monday, July 8th, Pompeo and I briefed Trump about what to expect, with Pompeo saying we thought Macron would propose a steep concession just to begin negotiations, which was just what Kerry and Obama did, a bad idea. Trump replied, "We can make a deal in a day. There is no real reason to ease sanctions. Once we do that, they're hard to get back on," which was exactly correct. The discussion wandered around for a while, and the subject of Iran's uranium enrichment activities came up. "We may need to hit it," said Trump. And then he was back to wondering, unhelpfully, about when Milley would take over from Dunford. Should we get Milley involved? We may need to do this in 2 weeks. If you put 20 tomahawks into a doorway, I don't give a fuck what they say, that's bad. That was correct too, although I had no idea which doorway he had in mind or from where he had plucked the number 20. What Pompeo and I didn't know, nor did anyone else at State or the NSC, and certainly did not approve, was that Mnuchin had been negotiating quietly with French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire to do just what Trump said he wouldn't do. I learned this from Mulvaney, who said Mnuchin had called him to report we had a deal with Iran, which Mnuchin essentially repeated to me later. Neither Pompeo nor I knew anything about Mnuchin's discussions with Le Maire, although Mnuchin claimed this was somehow agreed at the Trump-Macron D-Day lunch. Besides, this sounded a lot like Mnuchin's trade negotiations with the Chinese. A deal was always done or just about done. Mnuchin apparently never saw a negotiation where he couldn't make enough concessions to clinch a deal. When Trump spoke with Macron, it struck me maybe even Trump didn't know Mnuchin had been trying to give away the store when Macron raised the Mnuchin-Le Maire negotiations. After a Trump discourse on Kerry and the Logan Act, Macron asked directly what Trump would be willing to give up, thereby precisely demonstrating his mentality to make concessions to Iran without getting anything in return. Although Trump first ducked, they did discuss before the call ended the idea of a significant reduction in the oil and financial sanctions against Iran for a brief period, and Trump seemed to be clearly leaning in that direction. This was exactly what Pompeo and I had been struggling to prevent. Another disaster. After a customary Oval Office event for new ambassadors to present their credentials, I stayed behind to ask him to explain his offer to Macron. Trump disparaged Macron, but said he's the kind of guy who could make the deal. It's only some of the oil sanctions for a brief period, he said, which was better than the other proposals he'd discussed with Macron, and which is what I conveyed immediately to my new French counterpart, Emmanuel Bonn. I don't mind oil, said Trump. You can always turn that, the sanctions, back on. This, of course, was exactly the opposite of what he had said to Pompeo and me earlier, prompting Pompeo to say he would call Graham, Cruz, and Tom Cotton to stir up Republican opposition to negotiations. I sent Pompeo the record of the call and spoke to him later in the day. The concession on relieving the oil sanctions was beyond belief to him, as it was to me, because it showed that Trump did not understand the damage that would be done to our overall maximum pressure effort by dialing sanctions up and down like a rheostat. Once again, Pompeo was ready to resign, and he said it was only a matter of time until we both made that call. He said, "We may put this fire out, but the next one will be worse," and trailed off. All we could do was hope that Iran would come to our rescue one more time. I wasn't entirely passive on that score, encouraging Netanyahu to call Trump on July 10th to stiffen his spine. Within 2 hours, Trump tweeted, "Iran has long been secretly enriching in total violation of the terrible $150 billion deal made by John Kerry and the Obama administration. Remember, that deal was to expire in a short number of years. Sanctions will soon be increased substantially." We were developing an escort program for commercial vessels in the Gulf, known as Operation Sentinel, with the Saudis and Emiratis participating, as well as Brits and other Europeans, which would at least discourage that form of Iranian interference with global oil markets. Earlier on July 4th, UK Royal Marines, acting at the request of Gibraltar's government, had seized the Iranian-owned Grace 1 tanker for violating EU sanctions on Syria. In response, on July 10th, Iran tried to seize the UK-owned British Heritage tanker in the Strait of Hormuz. On July 13th, it did capture an Emirati-owned Panamanian-flagged tanker, the Ria, and then on July 19th, they finally got what they wanted, seizing the UK-flagged, Swedish-owned Stena Impera. Obviously, Iran aimed to swap the Grace 1, by now renamed Adrian Darya 1, for the Stena Impera, although the two seizures were hardly equivalent. Unfortunately, a swap was just what the Brits were looking for. Clearly, the game was still very much afoot, unless and until we had Operation Sentinel in place, which was proving more difficult than anticipated because many countries hesitated to join. Part of the hesitation was doubtless due to the instinct for appeasement, but part of it was due to uncertainty about U.S. resolve and staying power because of Trump's erratic moves. Due both to their devotion to saving the Iran nuclear deal and their desire not to have anything else distract from the existential imperative of achieving Brexit, even Boris Johnson's new government didn't hold firm, releasing the Grace 1 under a commitment not to offload its oil cargo in Syria, a promise worth exactly what London received in return for it. They simply didn't want to have a struggle. Another bad lesson, doubtless duly noted in Tehran. The next day, July 11th, my new French counterpart, Emmanuel Bon, called me from Paris, having just returned from Iran. Khamenei himself, he said, had flatly rejected his efforts. Iran's formula was maximum resistance to maximum pressure, which was exactly the line Iran began to use publicly. While some sanctions relief could allow negotiations, Iran's ballistic missile program was off the table entirely, Zarif had made clear. Rouhani had been equally firm. Iran believed it would win in the end, and they were ready to oppose U.S. escalation with any available means. When Bon said Macron asked for an economic ceasefire, Rouhani said he wanted such a ceasefire, but only the total lifting of U.S. sanctions would bring Iran back into compliance with the nuclear deal, which was ridiculous. Just to be clear, Rouhani had also stressed that the Supreme Leader approved this position. I promised to let Trump know of his report and went to see him about 3:30 p.m. Trump responded, "That's it. Withdraw the offer. Sanction the shit out of them. Get ready to hit the ... sites," an ellipsis required here by the pre-publication clearance process, which we had discussed back and forth. Then Trump was back to getting out of Syria. As I left the Oval, Mnuchin was waiting outside, so I took the opportunity to tell him the good news about the collapse of the French effort with Iran. Rand Paul, by this time, was working to have Zarif come from New York to Washington to meet with Trump, as North Korea's Kim Jong-chol had done the year before. Just in case, I prepared at home a typed copy of my two-sentence resignation letter, handwritten in June, to bring in at a moment's notice. I was ready. Despite the rebuff from Iran, Macron's effort to make concessions to keep the nuclear deal alive resumed unabated. This was not improving the nuclear deal, but degrading it even further, in desperate and increasingly dangerous ways, simply to keep the shell of the agreement alive. It would have been laughable were Trump not succumbing to the subversion of his own stated policy. Trump had moments where he came back on course, such as when he finally publicly repudiated the Rand Paul gambit on July 19th. He said to me the next day, "Rand Paul is not the right person to negotiate this. He's a peacenik. I got out of that yesterday, did you see?" I didn't let the opportunity pass to note that Mark Levin, on his radio show the night before, had said that Paul's foreign policy was essentially the same as that of Ilhan Omar, the radical Democratic House member from Minnesota. On a subsequent Macron call, Trump explained about the defensive action the USS Boxer, an amphibious assault vessel, had taken, shooting down an Iranian drone coming unacceptably close to the ship. At least we were still defending ourselves, although the cost of the Iranian drone was trivial compared to that of the downed Global Hawk. Macron had nothing new to offer, and Trump continued to assert he would speak directly with the Iranians. Macron's direction remained unchanged. Trump seemed to understand this from time to time, as on August 8th, when he said to me about Macron, "Everything he touches turns to shit." That had the right tone. Pompeo and I discussed Macron's involvement continuously, and later that day, after meeting with Trump, Pompeo burst into my office and, laughing already, said, "I've solved your problem for you. He has tweeted about Macron by now for sure. Look it up." which I quickly did, finding that just minutes earlier, Trump had proclaimed, "Iran is in serious financial trouble. They want desperately to talk to the U.S., but are given mixed signals from all of those purporting to represent us, including President Macron of France. I know Emmanuel means well, as do all others, but nobody speaks for the United States but the United States itself. No one is authorized in any way, shape, or form to represent us." Pompeo and I were now rolling in the aisles, believing mistakenly that Macron's effort was effectively dead. It was not. That was evident as preparations for the Biarritz G7 in late August accelerated. Despite rumors France invited Rouhani to attend as a guest, Bonn repeatedly denied to me this was true. And it wasn't true. They were inviting Zarif. Trump was wildly unenthusiastic about attending yet another G7 after the fun at Charlevoix in 2018, and several times told me and others he would arrive late and leave early. The French were trying to nibble us to death on deliverables from the G7 and being generally unhelpful on logistics and security issues, which was driving the Secret Service and White House advance teams to distraction. Substantively, Bonn and others were clear Iran was Macron's highest priority, which was obviously worrying. Macron was not taking no for an answer, in part because Mnuchin was still encouraging with Le Maire the idea that there was a deal to be done. Trump was so uninterested in the G7, it was hard for Kudlow and me to schedule a briefing for him, but we finally did on Tuesday, August 20th, 4 days before the summit began. Trump heard a long list of complaints from Kudlow, the Secret Service, and the White House advance people, so he decided to call Macron with us all in the Oval, reaching him at about 5 p.m. Washington time. Trump had others address the issues and then launched into complaining about how badly Macron had treated him on earlier visits, like the famous insult about nationalism versus patriotism at the November Armistice Day ceremony. Macron broke in to say it was 11 p.m. in France and that he had asked for a phone call 2 days earlier. Trump exploded, pausing on the call to turn to me and said, "I wasn't told about that. God damn it, Bolton, you should have told me. I hear that from everybody. Give me those fucking calls." I said that, in fact, Macron had not done so, but Trump was not dissuaded. Reportedly, Trump had, early on, accused Michael Flynn of withholding a call to him from Putin. Perhaps Trump thought he was still the victim of an ongoing conspiracy. I came close to walking out of the Oval at that point, but that would have required resigning, which I was certainly close to doing. I didn't want to do so over this point, however, since he and Macron were both wrong. Bonn had emailed me for several days asking when we would arrive in Biarritz, and I had emailed back that we were still working on it, looking for a time to hear from Trump what his preference was. The day before, Bonn had asked that Macron brief Trump on his recent meeting with Putin in Moscow. I suggested we schedule it once we had our G7 planning session with Trump so the two leaders could discuss both issues. Bonn agreed, which was entirely sensible and efficient for both sides. Of course, I didn't tell Bonn that, in my assessment, Trump had until then paid no attention whatever to the G7. This conversation with Macron rambled on to 6 p.m. When it finished, I stayed behind to pin down a decision on whether Trump should travel to Denmark after the summit. Trump had calmed down by then and began dictating a tweet on why he wasn't going to Denmark but would in the future. With that in hand, as I was leaving the Oval, I was handed a note from Kupperman saying that another MQ-9 drone had been shot down, this one apparently by the Houthis over Yemen. Although we were still receiving information, the Houthis had already claimed credit in social media, so I went back in to tell Trump. Trump responded immediately, "I want retribution. Bring me some options later," which I said we would do. Back in my office, I told Kupperman what Trump had said to me in the Macron call, and Kupperman said, "Trump should apologize to you." I said, "That's never going to happen." The next day, however, after the regular intel briefing, I stayed behind to show Trump the printed-out email exchange between Bonn and myself, showing that a possible Macron-Trump call had been well under control and certainly not withheld from him. I had no expectation Trump would read the emails any more than he read most other things, but I did want him to know I had spoken honestly when I said I had not kept Macron from reaching him. Trump responded, "I shouldn't have yelled at you. I'm sorry, I have too much respect for you, but people don't get through to me." This last sentence was as inaccurate then as it had been the evening before, but it was hardly worth contesting in the abstract. I left for Biarritz early on Friday, August 23rd, flying through the day and arriving there in the early evening to make preparations for Trump's arrival midday on Saturday. He reached his hotel at 1:30, and we heard unexpectedly he would have lunch with Macron at 2 p.m., which was not previously scheduled. I had committed to do other meetings, which I hastily canceled to get to the Hotel du Palais, where the G7 leaders were staying. When I arrived, Trump and Macron were sitting at a table on the veranda doing a press conference. Others on the French and U.S. delegations were gathered around a separate table nearby. What I did not learn until the next day, Sunday, was that Iran was almost the sole topic between Macron and Trump, specifically whether Trump should meet with Zarif, who was on his way to Biarritz, probably from Paris, where he had been holed up since meeting Macron the day before. Trump later told Abe that the one-on-one lunch with Macron was the best hour and one half he'd ever spent. On Sunday morning, Trump and Britain's Boris Johnson had breakfast, their first meeting since Johnson had become prime minister. Inevitably, the subject of Iraq came up, and Johnson engaged in some friendly teasing by saying, "I agree with the president that democracy building was a mistake. Are we done with the regime change era, John?" I laughed and said, "Well, that's a sensitive subject," but made the point that pursuing regime change in certain circumstances was not the same thing as democracy promotion or nation building. Out of nowhere, Trump then said, "John's done a good job. When he walks into a room, Xi Jinping and these others take notice," which caused general merriment as he turned to me, smiled, and said, "It's true." That was nice, while it lasted. The G7 meetings proceeded through lunch on Sunday until the bombshell hit, as rumors swept through the Bellevue Conference Center that Zarif was on a plane landing imminently in Biarritz. As we tried to get the facts, I received an email from Pompeo asking that I call him immediately, which I did, at about 3:40 p.m. He reported a call he had just had with Netanyahu about an Israeli airstrike in Syria the night before, directed against Iranian threats to Israel, a not infrequent occurrence because, unlike the Trump administration, Israel did not hesitate to squash threats preemptively. We discussed how we should proceed in light of the Israeli strike, and I then told Pompeo what I was hearing about Zarif's showing up in Biarritz, which he didn't know anything about. I explained I was about to head back to the Bellevue and would keep him posted. There, I tracked Mulvaney down, and he said he was unaware of any possible contact with Zarif, although he had heard the same rumors I had. I sent a note into the G7 leaders' meeting for Kellyanne Shaw, the U.S. Sherpa, to pass to Trump, describing what we knew of Zarif's whereabouts. She sent a note back saying Trump had read mine and told her Macron had invited him to meet Zarif today. "POTUS definitely wants to do this," she wrote. I sat alone in an unused bilateral meeting room to gather my thoughts. I told NSC staff to get in touch with our pilots to create an alternative flight itinerary for later that day or Monday. Instead of going to Kiev and the other stops before Warsaw, I wanted a flight plan back to Joint Base Andrews. I didn't say why, but if Trump met with Zarif, my inclination was to return home and resign. I could see no purpose for continuing the rest of the trip if I knew I would resign when I finally got back to the White House. I decided I might as well do it now and get it over with. Bizarrely, we then had a Trump bilateral with Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison where Iran barely came up, and I rode in Trump's motorcade back to the Hotel du Palais to talk to him privately about this Zarif meeting. By then I had an email from Pompeo, who had again spoken to Netanyahu. Netanyahu had heard about the possible Zarif meeting and was pressing to call Trump at 5:30 p.m. Biarritz time, which was fast approaching. After arriving at the hotel, I spoke again with Pompeo while waiting to meet Trump in his suite. I told him I would do what I could about Netanyahu's call, but I was determined to make one more effort to talk Trump out of meeting with Zarif. Netanyahu and Israel's Ambassador Ron Dermer were also calling me, so I asked Pompeo to tell them I felt like the Light Brigade. Outcome TBD. On Trump's floor, I found Mulvaney and Kushner. Kushner was on the phone to David Friedman, U.S. Ambassador to Israel, telling Friedman that he was not going to allow Netanyahu's call to go through. Now we knew who was stopping all those calls to Trump. When he hung up, Kushner explained he had stopped this and an earlier effort by Netanyahu because he didn't think it was appropriate for a foreign leader to talk to Trump about whom he should speak to. I told Mulvaney I needed to brief Trump on Israel's overnight military activity in Syria as well as Iran. Mulvaney said Trump had told him in the car to the hotel that Macron had used the Saturday lunch with Trump to make the invitation to meet Zarif. Trump had then invited Mnuchin over to their table to discuss the Zarif issue and to suggest that Mnuchin meet with Zarif in lieu of Trump. Mulvaney said Trump also told him Kushner knew about the possible Zarif meeting. I went into Trump's suite at about 5:25, accompanied by Mulvaney and Kushner. Trump started off by asking why I hadn't wanted to do the Sunday talk shows. I explained Mnuchin, Kudlow, and Lighthizer had rightly done them that day because of our efforts to refocus the G7 on economic rather than political issues. Trump accepted the explanation, which at least had the small virtue of being true. I then described to Trump the Israeli military operation. Trump raised Zarif, said he wanted to meet with him, and asked, "Do you think it's a good idea?" "No, sir, I do not," I answered, and then laid out why this was not the moment to meet, let alone to relax the economic sanctions, let alone still further to extend the $5 to $15 billion credit line France had proposed and Mnuchin had been negotiating with Le Maire. I said that once we took the pressure off Iran, it would be very hard to put it back on, just like with North Korea. Even a little economic relief went a long way to sustaining countries under tough sanctions, but we had no way of knowing how much actual behavioral change we were going to get from Iran. Trump asked Mulvaney and Kushner what they thought. Mulvaney agreed with me, but Kushner said he would have the meeting because there was nothing to lose. These people had an attention span no longer than the deal in front of them. Then, as if a light went off in Trump's head, he said, "They're not getting any line of credit until the whole deal's done. I'm not agreeing to anything just to get them to stop violating the nuclear deal." That, of course, was the precise opposite of what Macron was proposing. Although Trump's comment was better than where I feared ending up, I still pressed him not to meet with Zarif. "I still think I'll see him," Trump said. "It would be in private, maybe just a handshake." I again urged him not to do it, and the meeting ended. Out in the hallway, Mulvaney, Kushner, and I spoke for a few minutes more. I explained that Macron had a screw loose if he thought any reputable financial institution was waiting around to extend a line of credit to Iran. We all at least agreed Macron was a weasel, that was my recollection, and that he would try to take credit for whatever meeting did take place. I came away more convinced that Mulvaney had not known anything about this mess until I spoke with him at the Bellevue Center earlier in the afternoon. I called Pompeo a third time at about 6:15 p.m. to fill him in. "So, we have Mnuchin and Jared, two Democrats, running our foreign policy," he said when I finished my report, which struck me as about right. He added, "We have a substance problem here, and a massive process problem, both of which were clear. It's the president's inclination to have this meeting, and he's canvassing the world until he finds someone who agrees with him. Also correct. I responded that if the meeting took place, I would undoubtedly resign, and that even if it didn't, I might resign anyway. "I'm with you," said Pompeo. I waited into the evening for word Trump's meeting with Zarif had taken place, expecting to be awakened to hear the news at some point, but it never came. The next day, Monday, August 24th, I concluded, amazingly, there had been no meeting. There was certainly no media coverage of a meeting, although French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian had met with Zarif for over 3 hours, joined at one point by Macron. The French told Kellyanne Shaw that Macron gave Trump a one-on-one readout of those conversations in Trump's hotel room, but apparently informed no one else. When I talked to Mulvaney just before Trump's first bilateral that morning, he said he didn't think there had been a meeting with Zarif. I emailed this news to Pompeo at about 10:30 a.m., saying I couldn't rule out a phone call, and I also wasn't sure whether Kushner or Mnuchin might have met or spoken with Zarif to create a future channel of communication. This latter hypothesis was something that I believed agitated and worried senior Israeli officials, and which, of course, made Pompeo livid. I don't know if I alone talked Trump out of meeting Zarif, but the decision was enough for me to travel on to Kiev rather than return home. Still, how much longer could it be before Trump made a truly bad, irreversible mistake? Yet again, we had only postponed, and maybe not for long, the day of reckoning.